This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
When it comes to solving the housing crisis, are we thinking too big? Like our expectations too massive? Should young Australians be downsizing their dreams? Could the answer be tiny homes? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up later, we are talking tiny homes and speaking with those who are deciding to give it a go.
So it's going to be my first time that I have my very own space, and it's wholly and solely mine.
Yeah, if you've thought about getting a tiny home, I'd love to hear from you. It turns out they are a bit more complicated than you might think. A bit of red tape to get around. We're going to explore all of that soon. Also ahead, the country taking a pretty bold move to stop young people smoking. We'll explain that. First though,
you're listening to Hack.
New York, tonight you have delivered a mandate for change.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the election of a new mayor isn't usually the biggest political story in the world, but we are talking about New York, baby. And even if you know nothing about this specific election, chances are you've seen something about Zoran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York, who's taken social media by storm, not just because he's young, younger than most politicians, but because he's been doing things a little differently. So what is his win going to mean for politics? Is there a shift happening here, or is this a lot of hype? We're going to ask those questions in a bit. But first, here's April McLennan.
Another candidate has joined the race for mayor of New York City.
It's just a local government election in one city a long way from Australia, but it's basically had the internet everywhere obsessed.
The reason why I'm going to vote for him is because he's hot. Bring back hot politicians.
From his camos at gay clubs.
For creating a space for queer and trans New Yorkers.
To his slick TikTok vids.
Zoran Mamdani will build a better future for all New Yorkers.
One of the candidates has been a social media explosion, and now the 34-year-old has done it.
The future is in our hands.
He's the new mayor of America's biggest and most important city.
My friends, we have toppled a political dynasty.
So who is this guy? Well, Zoran Mamdani is a democratic socialist who's taken the party in a dramatic left-wing direction.
New Yorkers are hungry for a new kind of politics, a politics that puts working people first.
Mamdani will be New York's first Muslim mayor. And on the campaign, he proposed making it free to travel on buses, freezing rent on some types of apartments, and dramatically raising taxes on the rich.
We can tell billionaires that this city doesn't just belong to them. And we can tell Andrew Cuomo that New York City is not for sale.
In the race to be mayor, Mamdani's main challenger was a guy as established as it gets, the former New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo initially tried to be the Democratic Party's candidate, but failed to make a comeback. His time as governor ended after a sexual harassment scandal that forced him to resign 4 years ago.
And I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
In the end, in the race for mayor, Cuomo ran against Mamdani as an independent. His other challenger for mayor was a Republican called Curtis Sliwa, who had some weird moments on the campaign.
Whereas I exude confidence, strength, fight, like Braveheart. And at the end of Braveheart, remember, they capture him and they impale him, they gut him out. That's me, Braveheart.
But I'd prefer not to have a communist mayor of New York City.
A big part of what's made a basically small race in New York an international story is Mamdani's relationship with America's most powerful man.
One I'm going to be watching over him very carefully on behalf of the nation.
Yeah, so Donald Trump isn't a fan. And the US president has threatened to cut off federal funding to New York if the new mayor doesn't behave.
We don't need a communist in this country.
During the primary, Mamdani took aim at President Trump.
I am Donald Trump's worst nightmare.
So it's not a big surprise the two have beef.
We'll use their power to reject Donald Trump's fascism.
Mamdani grew up in Uganda and both his parents are from India. With that background and his left-wing politics, people all around the world are wondering if it's a signal of a bigger shift in politics.
Mamdani presents something different to what we're seeing politically in other parts of the world.
Manan Luthra is a journalist at Indian Link Media Group here in Australia. While Mamdani's opponents are immediately questioning if he can actually do a lot of the things he campaigned on, Manan reckons young people see Mamdani as a real symbol of hope.
Young people and the diaspora are very passionate about taking action and taking action for good. And they see that in him and they see that reflected in what he's achieved.
Hack on Triple J.
April McLennan reporting there, hearing from a lot of you on the text line, but also on Hack's Instagram, where we've had some news of Mamdani's win for a few hours. Laura saying, great news. I'd love to have someone like that in Australia. Indy says, optimism is back. But then Jack says, let's just wait to see what he actually does. We've also got a voice note from Carter. Carter is at a Mamdani party in New York.
It's a very youthful and exciting and modern shifting that's happening, and it aligns with so much of the young population of New York. And it just finally feels like what is happening in this city is reflective of what so much of the city wants.
Yeah, there's Carter at a party for Mamdani in New York, sounding pretty coherent for so early in the morning New York time. Look, let's get into this a little bit more now with an Australian who is also living in New York City. Jeremy Hymans is one of Australia's most powerful political activists. He co-founded GetUp, which is the progressive Australian political activist group, and now he's started Purpose, which is a social impact agency. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. You just heard from Carter. You're also in New York. What does it feel like at the moment?
A lot of energy. This was a really clear victory that Mamdani had. And this is kind of really improbable. Like, no one really saw this coming. I think even 7-8 months ago, the idea that that this relatively obscure state assemblyman would become mayor of the largest city in America, people would not have believed that story if you told it to them.
How significant is it for progressives in particular?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, Mamdani represents very much not the establishment of the Democratic Party, right? And in the US, there's a faction of the Democrats called the Democratic Socialists that he's very much part of, like AOC. It is unusual for those candidates to win and win as emphatically as Mamdani has done. You know, his message is very much directed at rebuilding a multiracial working class coalition, which is what the Democrats badly need to do if they're going to offset Trump. And young people have been totally ignited by it here in New York. And, you know, thousands and thousands of volunteers.
Yeah, how important were young people in really deciding this election?
Well, they were really important in winning the primary. Mamdani kind of came from nowhere because so many young people showed up. And you can't always count on young people to show up to vote in America. You know, even the candidacies of Bernie Sanders and others, the very strong youth support for those candidacies were not enough. And so this is an example of where young people really did make the difference. But it wasn't just young people. It was also this really kind of rainbow coalition that Mamdani built of immigrant communities. So, you know, it was kind of everyone from white, highly educated young progressives to Hindu taxi drivers and Muslim communities in New York and, you know, right across the spectrum. And it's a really interesting and unusual coalition that he put together to win this victory.
Were there any particular parts of his campaign or the way he campaigned that you thought were pretty interesting or really got your attention?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think he just comes across as a really sincere person who kind of believes what he says, and he's very affable. He's really likable. And so I think that makes a big difference, especially when you're carrying in the US a kind of progressive message. It's very easy for progressives to be dismissed as angry. And Mamdani doesn't come across as angry at all. So I think that his political skills are really significant. You know, he's a really skilled communicator. And I think his emphasis on affordability, and he came across like a person who actually cared and wasn't just in the pocket of powerful interests.
You talked about some of the qualities that Mamdani kind of encapsulates being important for the Democrats more broadly. I'm wondering, do you think that this win will actually change the way the Democrats are positioning themselves in the United States? Or do you think that a lot of leading Democrats might be trying to distance themselves from Mamdani?
Well, I mean, look, I think what works in New York City is not a formula that works nationally from the perspective of your policy and your message. Like, that's clear. America is the really big country, and New York City is the exception rather than the rule. But I think the lesson for Democrats is don't behave like a robot. Behave like you actually care. Be authentic politically. And those qualities work no matter what your positioning is. People are less interested in your orthodoxy and your policy positions down to the final detail, and they're more interested in whether you can inspire them, excite them, and make them believe that you care about their problems. You know, many of the establishment Democrats look old, stale, robotic. And so someone like Mamdani emerges and says, there's a different way to do this. And so I think you'll see a lot of people take those cues from him, but not necessarily adopt every policy position that he advocates.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with political activist, commentator Jeremy Hyman's based in New York about the New York City mayoral election. Zoran Mamdani winning that race today, making headlines all around the world, including here in Australia. Hearing from you on the text line now, Josh in Canberra says, okay, we've heard a lot of the buzzwords, but what exactly can a mayor achieve? That's an interesting point, Jeremy. For people in Australia, how powerful is the role of New York mayor in the United States? Because a lot is being said about how this might impact President Donald Trump and his presidency.
Well, yeah, look, the mayor of New York City is a really important symbolic role. I mean, it's also a very managerial role, but it has a certain symbolic power, right? You think about Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York City during 9/11, and he became this national hero for a period of time, and now he's sort of a national disgrace. You know, so I think that the role is very high profile in the right hands. And what Trump is going to do is very intentionally turn Mamdani into the antagonist, right? So he thinks that the more Democrats nationally are associated with Mamdani, and he's stoking up racist fears about Mamdani, and he's obviously depicting Mamdani as a kind of extremist, he is going to go after New York City precisely so that he can stage conflict that he thinks benefits him politically. So stay tuned for that.
Do you think there's been too much weight put on this election?
Well, I don't think there's been too much attention, because I think that there's really powerful lessons here. But I think it's also important to pay attention to what else has happened tonight in the US. So there were elections in Virginia and New Jersey for governor. Democrats absolutely romped home in those elections. Really big victories in both of those states, which tells you a lot just about, you know, the motivation of Democratic voters to kind of move against Trump right now. But that doesn't mean that the threat that Trump poses to democratic institutions, to vulnerable communities in the United States and to the world is significantly lessened by tonight. It isn't.
Jeremy Hyman's co-founder, chairman of Purpose. Appreciate you coming on Hack.
No worries. All the best.
And still a lot of messages coming through. Someone says establishment Democrats backing Cuomo in the run-up spoke for itself. And then Alice saying, finally, a silver lining to the dumpster fire of US politics.
Hack. Well, the Maldives has outlawed the purchase and use of tobacco by anyone born after January 2007.
On Triple J.
Yeah, is the answer to stopping younger generations from taking up smoking just to make it illegal? Because countries around the world have been throwing around this idea for a while. You might remember a few years ago, New Zealand announced this plan to ban tobacco for anyone born after 2009. But then later, a new government scrapped that idea. Well, now the Maldives is doing it. Anyone born on or after the 1st of January 2007 can never buy tobacco, ever. So will this work? Well, Becky Freeman is a professor of public health at the University of Sydney, and she's with me now. Hey, Becky, thank you so much for coming on. What do you make of this move from the Maldives?
Well, first, I'd really like to congratulate the Maldives on recognizing what a harmful product tobacco is, and that they wanted to be innovative and take steps in order to, you know, really push back against what has been one of the greatest public health challenges we've ever faced. But I also really want to make it clear that there's no silver bullets in tobacco control. So this sort of measure needs to be part of, you know, a broad approach that considers all the, you know, aspects of tobacco use, the marketing, the price, how it's sold. But yes, absolutely, they should be congratulated for making this move.
Is there any evidence to suggest that this might work? Because there might be some listening now thinking, oh, if you make it illegal, it could just see this boom of, underground activity, black market happening. Mm. We're seeing similar things in Australia now with vapes.
Yeah, I really want to push back against the assumption that if we do something in tobacco control, it's going to automatically lead to an illicit market. Obviously, like, this law doesn't prevent those who are already over 18, who are already addicted, from buying and using tobacco products. So they're not part of this new law. But what it does do is to protect that next generation who hasn't yet taken up smoking from ever having done that. And youth smoking rates, you know, in Australia are really low. They're less than about 2% of teenagers have ever smoked. And so it's a law that could, you know, work well as part of a complement of the things we do here.
So you could see something like this happening in Australia?
I could. I mean, we almost had it, as you said in your opener, in New Zealand. It took a change in government that was heavily influenced by the tobacco industry to repeal that law. It is coming in place in the UK, it looks like, as well. It just needs to go through a couple of last steps through their parliament. So I could absolutely see it being part of a big suite of measures that we adopt in Australia.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Becky Freeman, a professor of public health at the University of Sydney. We're talking about smoking and moves to combat smoking among younger generations. The Maldives announcing they're going to be banning smoking for anyone born after 2007. They won't be able to ever buy tobacco products. Becky, how are we going with smoking rates amongst young people? Because, you know, they were going down for years and then we saw a bit of a lift, didn't we? Is that continuing?
It depends on how you're looking at it. So obviously the most major issue we faced in the last few years is the advent of vaping and how we had absolutely, you know, a frenzy of retailers selling illicit nicotine products to teenagers and to young adults alike. And that has really been a massive problem. Fortunately, we have passed laws to try and get that under control. We're having some issues with enforcement, but we will get there. Smoking rates have continued to turn down, particularly in teenagers. For young adults, they do have some of the highest smoking rates of all groups in Australia. And for me, those haven't been coming down as quickly. We need to be really careful before we start saying, you know, smoking rates are increasing or, you know, they're out of control. I really, as a researcher, I want to make sure we are relying on really robust data, really strong data, and independent data for that. But I am really concerned. You know, we know that illicit tobacco is undermining people who are trying to quit. And we know that young people who vape are 5 times more likely to take up smoking. So we could see increases in smoking rates in the next couple of years if we don't crack down.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say you've got to make sure the evidence is there and want to be backed up by legitimate figures. But I guess the black market cigarettes do seem to be a massive problem across this country.
Absolutely. And look, as a researcher, I want to know precisely how big that problem is. I want to know where they're being sold, who they're being sold to. But I think your average person can walk outside their house and see that there have been so many more tobacconists popping up.
How are tobacco companies dealing with all of these changing restrictions, laws here and around the world?
The tobacco industry is the problem. The reason why we have a tobacco epidemic is because the tobacco industry has marketed and sold and distributed these products through sophisticated commercial supply chains for decades, and we've done very little to push back against that. We've done really well in making cigarettes less attractive to people, so they're expensive, they have health warnings on them, we've banned advertising, we've got quit programs. But what we haven't done very well is support all those public health measures with controlling supply. We've allowed the tobacco industry to continue to have close relationships with retailers, to control how cigarettes are imported into Australia, how they're sold here. And if we hope to both reduce smoking rates and reduce the illicit market. We need to do both, not just reduce the illicit market. Then we have got to seize control of that supply chain. And we also need to shut the shops. We have far too many retailers selling these products. Cigarettes are more available than prescription medicines, and they're more available than fresh fruit and vegetables. You go to get petrol in the morning, petrol stations sell cigarettes. You go to buy groceries, grocery stores sell cigarettes. You go to get a cold drink at a convenience store, they sell cigarettes. And now those sorts of places are also selling cheap illicit products. And if far fewer places were selling them, it'd be a lot easier for people to quit too.
Becky Freeman, Professor of Public Health at the University of Sydney, appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
And heaps of comments coming through on this. Someone says, I actually recently returned from the Maldives and I noticed when I was flying in that you can't buy vapes there. Someone else says the black market is going to be loving this. Another person, prohibition and overregulation does not work on its own. We need to address the systemic reasons that lead to people smoking in the first place. Someone else says, I think we need to ban alcohol too, is that person's opinion. And another person says they'll never ban tobacco products. Governments earn too much money from the tax on them.
Hack.
They're a really great option for those who can afford them. If you're in a position to do so, yeah, go for it.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about housing lately, always. But yesterday, you might remember on the show, the shadow housing minister telling us that he wants to see house prices drop. Bit of a unique take for a politician from a major party. Don't often hear that. And we also heard from the shadow housing minister that we're not going to get out of this housing crisis with any one solution. So could one of the answers be tiny homes? Those really cute pocket-sized little cabin things that you might see in really picturesque locations. Maybe you've stayed in one on a weekend away, something like that. Well, Shalala Mador has been speaking to some Australians who've been thinking about giving tiny homes a go.
Business is booming for tiny home builder Ben Anderson.
It's been good. This is the fifth one we've built and sixth is currently under construction.
It takes Ben about 3 months to build a customised tiny home.
Try to do a good quality job for a more reasonable price than building a full house or granny flat, yeah.
Ben's business is part of the booming tiny home industry.
I was able to find an absolute maximum possibility of 39 companies in Australia that could build tiny houses. There's now well over 300.
Faye Barrett runs the Tiny Homes Expo and reckons tiny homes are getting more popular with young people.
The demographic is just getting younger and younger each year.
I'm currently sitting at the dining room table looking at where it will go eventually.
Ainsley Kime is 29 and lives in Rockhampton.
It ticked all the right boxes as well as functionality and price-wise.
And she realised the only shot she had at owning her own place was to buy a tiny home.
You know, to be completely bleak, there's no hope in sight. I could not imagine going back into the housing market. It's not on my wish list.
She's super excited about her tiny home, which will arrive in a few weeks.
So it's going to be my first time in 29 years that I have my very own space and it's wholly and solely mine.
Ainsley's helped design the place, but that doesn't come cheap.
The whole build is going to be about 145 grand.
That's about standard for a customisable tiny home. The average cost is around $150,000 to $200,000, according to people in the industry. And Ainsley acknowledges that she's one of the lucky ones because she's able to park on her parents' property and doesn't have to rent land.
Yeah, increasingly I saw that what was an affordable option sort of started to shift a little bit.
Melbourne woman Ayla was drawn to the lifestyle that tiny homes offered. But when she looked into it, she realised even a tiny home was out of her reach.
You have to take into consideration the cost of the actual tiny home itself, things like insurance. You've then got the cost of the land and renting the land, even though that's going up, does sort of feel that you're still in the rental market.
Ayla reckons the problem with tiny homes is the same as the rest of the housing market. People who have family help can get ahead, while people like her can't.
I feel like if you've got land in 2025, you know, that's gold. So, you know, having something like that is already a bit privileged in a way.
The upfront cost of a tiny home could, in some cases, be more than a normal property because it's a lot harder to get a loan. There isn't a set legal definition of what constitutes a tiny home, and because they aren't strictly considered houses, you can't get a mortgage on them. Jamie Mitchell is a financial broker who helps people get personal loans on tiny homes.
The loans are shorter, they're over 7 years. The interest rates are higher and it tends to make people a little bit more cash poor. So that limit that you can borrow is reduced as well.
Jamie says the number of people inquiring about loans for tiny homes has quadrupled in just a few years. And most of his business these days comes from millennials and Gen Z.
We are seeing a lot more people in their 20s and 30s. They're young working couples, and that has been a shift from what we saw historically. Probably at least half of what we're doing now fit in that demographic.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting there, production support from Ali Angeloni. And I should say the ABC is actually diving deep on housing at the moment. They want to hear about your experiences. So if that's buying your first home, if it struggles getting a rental, whatever it is, go to abc.net.au/housing. You can join the conversation there. Look, let's talk more about tiny homes now with Dr. Heather Shearer, an urban planning lecturer at Griffith University. She's with us now. Heather, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you reckon? Are tiny homes the answer to all our problems?
No, of course not.
Oh, great.
But they could be the answer to some niche housing needs affordability for some people. But from the perspective of the fact that tiny homes are very tiny, they won't necessarily be of appealing to everyone. And also, as was mentioned in the interview, they are quite expensive and you can't really get a mortgage on them.
Yeah. Well, we're hearing from a lot of people on the text line now. Someone says, we bought a 45-foot houseboat. A tiny home with council permits was way overpriced. Mm. Think outside the box. It does sound like that there is a lot of red tape that people might not be thinking about, and they can turn out to be pretty expensive.
Yeah, so one of the major things with tiny houses, I mean, obviously to pay, say, $150,000, which sounds like a horrendous amount of money, it's a lot cheaper per se than, you know, what's the median house price in Sydney and Brisbane at the moment, over $1 million, I think. But that, of course, includes the land and it's an appreciating asset, whereas a tiny house is considered as a caravan or a car or boat for that matter. So but it still requires then, you know, that someone either has to loan a reasonable amount of money on a personal loan, which is very expensive and short term, or else somehow have that amount of cash floating around. And I don't think many people of most generations do.
Yeah, it's definitely a massive problem, access to cash. Mm. We're hearing from people on the text line. Larissa from Hobart says, I really want to live in a tiny home, but I have nowhere to park it. And most councils don't allow a tiny home on wheels on a vacant block of land. I really hope that councils do reconsider and lift some of the restrictions. Another person, tiny houses are a great move for power and construction efficacy. Australia has comparatively such big floor plans when compared with other countries. Another person, the government needs to stop this madness in the market. It has the power, but greed prevails, is that person's comment there. Do you think, Dr. Shearer, that downsizing generally when it comes to housing is something that we need to start thinking about in the years ahead?
100%, yes. I mean, our houses are, generally speaking, some of the largest in the world, well, at least of the OECD, which is normally where the data is collected. So we definitely need to downsize. With regards to tiny houses, I suppose we have to differentiate, and this is really important, is tiny houses on wheels, which is the general sort of categorization, what people think of tiny houses. If you don't own property, they are great, but if you've got somewhere to park them, and we can go on to that later. But if you do own property, to be honest, you know, unless there's a huge amount of constraints over it, like bushfire zones and, you know, flooding and stuff like that, you'd be better off building yourself a fixed tiny house, like a, you know, just a small cottage or something, because most councils will let you build that. Because as soon as you put it on wheels, then it's considered a temporary dwelling. And then if you own property, which most people, you know, many people, particularly younger people, are not, you know, privileged enough to do so. I mean, many people, you know, we're going into older millennials and Gen Xers who also don't own land. So there, you know, it's a lot cheaper to do that and go to the bank and get a mortgage. Tiny houses on wheels, there's a bit of an equity issue with having tiny houses on wheels, because it's difficult to find places to put them. Most of them in Australia tend to be in like rural residential or rural areas on acreage, just because they're pretty much what they call under the radar. So where councils, they're not really sort of counted in planning schemes or anything, but generally speaking, if it's on like 4 acres or something, you know, really, unless there's conflict with the neighbours, no one really minds.
Yeah. Look, we are hearing problem, that that is a big issue. No, finding a place to put these tiny homes is what a lot of people are saying. Look, we've run out of time, unfortunately, Dr. Heather Shearer from Griffith Uni, but thank you very much for coming on. Appreciate your take. And we're hearing from so many of you on the text line now. Blake says, why are we talking about tiny homes in Australia when we have so much unused landmass? Matt from Bega says, housing's become too extravagant. There used to be an attitude of starting small and then increasing in size, but developers and designers are creating bigger homes that push young people out. And then Dan in Manly says, what next? Are we going to call an umbrella a solution to the housing crisis? Have you got an umbrella, Dan? If you've got one, we'd love to borrow it, frankly. That is all we've got time for on Hack for now. Although I will say the Hack Interview podcast up early tomorrow morning, it's Punters Politics, who you might know. He held a big event in Canberra this week. We talk about that, but also just his journey to become one of the most influential political podcasters in this country. He was a high school teacher a few years ago, and there's been this massive shift. So all of that will be up on the Hackpod early tomorrow morning, or right here on the radio show this time tomorrow. Hack.